Accession number 21118, Real 6.
Fred Cooper, Real 6.
And this law from the gate manned, was perfectly aware that this was a German sniper that had done the damage to him. And we had to restrain him. He wanted to get out, wounded as he was. He wanted to get at this German, and the German was just simply blowing raspberries at him. You know, this is what was going on in the ambulance. And then, while this was going on, there was about three attempts on this rifle brigade man to get at him. And as we're going along, looking out these patches, the air was full of aircraft. All sorts, you know, there was a big Lancaster bombers, there was smaller bombers, mosquitoes and everything. And the sky was black with it. Well, anyway, eventually the ambulance stopped at a main dress at a casualty clearance station. And when we got out, someone said that the air activity was due to the fact that that a large armoured German formation had been sighted in the wood, and our people had only put together the only or the first 1,000 bomber raid in daylight. You know, they had 1,000 bomber raids, but in night time. But they put 1,000 bomber raids together to get a concentration of shelling on this wood where this armoured formation were. And that was the answer to that. Well, when we got out of the vehicle, there was all sorts of people there, padres and that, offering cigarettes and cups of tea and perhaps, if anything, giving words of comfort to the more seriously wounded, you know. And I got behind the back of the queue. There was about six doctors examining. And I was at the back of the queue and I was with the German. He was in, I was at the back of one queue and he was in the back of the other queue. And he got down to his doctor before I got down to mine. Eventually, when I got down to mine, this doctor who was dealing with the German came over to the doctor who was dealing with me, and he said to me, my doctor, have a look at that, he said. So they showed him his hand, and it looked to me as if it had to be amputated. Whatever nationality the individual was, medically it was necessary to make an amputation. And this doctor who was dealing with the German said to my doctor, well, that's how it left to be, but you know what they'll bloody will say, he said, which meant, you know, that the Germans would be saying that he'd been amputated when it wasn't really necessary. But after that, I got finished up in Bayou General Hospital. And I was there, and typical army fashion, someone came along to me and said, you're flying home this afternoon, sign this. And they put about three sheets of documents down there where I had to put my signature about five times, and next thing I knew, I was on a duck down the road, off the road, into the sea, to an LST, which had been converted into a hospital ship. And that was again a surprising experience, because it was fitted out so that the casualties were in sort of tiers around the ship, and in the centre of the ship there was about five tables, operating tables, where the dock surgeons were carrying out operations on serious casualties in full view of everybody. But I was on the upper area because I could walk, and you know, I had no problem. I was walking wounded, but more serious ones, so we carried out operations on the ship. Anyway, we left and came back to Southampton, and I felt a bit, rather embarrassed about this, because I hadn't got a serious wound. It wasn't causing me hardly any discomfort. I knew that I had a bit of shrapnel in there, but it wasn't causing me any discomfort. And when we got off the ship, I was one of the first off the ship, and there was YMCA, Church of Scotland, Salvation Army, the Padres, all there, people ready to help me down and all that, as you got off the boat, help me down. And I felt rather embarrassed, and I thought, well, this is not justified with me. So I got taken to Park Pruitt Hospital, and that's in Basingstoke. They had trains there going in different directions, taking the casualties to different hospitals. And I was fortunate enough to go to Basingstoke. And I was in hospital there, and they looked at it, and he said, we're going to probe you, So they took me downstairs, and they got these probes, it was quite painful and all that, digging around. And I was on them M&B tablets at the time, because penicillin was a rare commodity. They were saying it cost something like £4,000 at that time to treat someone with penicillin. But he had a couple of probes at it. Then he came back to me, the doctor, and he said, well, we can't get that. He said, what we'd like to do, take you down tomorrow, he said, and put you under and have a good probe of it, So, sign. So he took me down, and I came up, felt a bit sore, and a couple of hours later, he came along, and first things, can't find anything, he said. It's there, he said, but he said, that part of your body, he said, is layers and layers of muscle. He said, it's probably tucked itself away behind that muscle. We can't get at it, he said. But he said, I don't think that's going to bother you for the rest of your life. And it never has, but it's still there, So anyway, with that, they transferred me to Leeds Infirmary. And I was there for a week. And then all I had there was a change of dressing until I didn't need dressings anymore, So with that, straight from the hospital, I went on a week's leave. Well, then I had to report back to Strensel in York. And I had a week's leave, and I went back to Strensel, and I had a surprise. Because since I got in the door at Strensel, I'd never been there before, someone shouted out to me, Fred, hello. And when I went over, it's surprising. We had a chap in the regiment when we were out in Africa and Italy, and he was in terms of soldiering, he was a real tearaway. When he went out on patrol, he used to fill himself up with hand grenades, and anything moved, it was an hand grenade into it, and he was highly decorated. He had a DCM and bar and a military medal and bar, and his name was Johnny Minns. And when I went in the gate at this barracks, there he was with a handful of letters. So I said, what are you doing with that, Johnny? He said, I'm the post corporal. So I said, Fred, I'm not worried, look. And he had a big dig there, and he lost
his forearm.
Yeah, and he'd lost the use of about four fingers. He said, I can only move them that far. He said, but I'm not worried, Fred. He said, I've had my share of it, he said, and I'm happy. And he was quite happy to carry on his post corporal. Johnny Minns, his name was. Corporal Minns. I remember he said, when I took over position from him, he said, have you got any grenades, Fred? I said, we've got a box here, Johnny, a dozen. Oh, you want more than that, he said. I'll bring you some up. He pulled up another two boxes. Grenade mad. But going back to the story now, where were
we? You're in Strensel.
Yeah, at Strensel. And anyway, when I was at Strensel, I was one of the first casualties back from Normandy. And consequently, I got whipped into the commanding officer's, or the officer commanding, into his office, and there was all the officers at a depot there inquiring about, you know, their school friends, who they were at Oxford or Cambridge or wherever they were. How was Mr. So-and-so? How was Mr. So-and-so? And that. Anyway, I satisfied him as best I could, said he was all right last time I saw him, you know, although unfortunately while I was out there, a shell had landed in an officer's O group, and the officer that was in charge of me crossing the Sandgrove, he got killed, the second in command of the company got killed, the company sergeant major got killed, and two other officers got wounded, and including the company commander Gibbs, landed bang on the O group. But I didn't know that. And when they asked me, I said, well, so-and-so was all right when I left. The company officer commanding the depot then said to me, well, look, on the basis of your experience, he said, I'd like you to remain at the depot, he said, to be an instructor, you know, advanced training for the recruits. Well, I went back and I thought to myself, I don't want that. The lads that I'd been with, you know, in the desert, in Italy, and in Normandy, you felt part of a family. And if you wasn't with them, you know, as much as when you're out there, you want to get home, when you are home, you feel that, you know, you're a coward, you're ducking out or something and all that. So I said to Johnny Mins, I said, I want to get back to debt with the lads, Johnny. No, don't blame you, Fred, you know. I can't, with his hand. So he said, but I understand that you have to write to a commanding officer and he has to claim you. Well, that was good enough for me. I went back and within a week I was on my way. And when I got there, surprisingly enough, they were no less than 200 yards from where I'd left them. All the plan for crossing the Oden and the Oden had been revised, and we were now in a situation immediately prior to the Falaise Pocket, which I got back to the company 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and at 6 o'clock I was on listening post. The edge of a cornfield.
What did that involve? What did that involve?
Our listening post is that you go out a section of six infantrymen or eight infantrymen, and you take up a position in a cornfield and you put a couple of men forward, and invariably you've got a very light pistol with a pre-arranged signal, you know, green over red, or red over green, which gives prior warning of an enemy attack. Well, the next thing that followed, as far as I remember, was the Falaise Pocket. Terrible sights. You know, I can remember moving around there when it broke up, you know. You used to see how typhoons come over, rocket firing typhoons, regular as clockwork, you know, and you, when the rockets hit the ground, you know, you can hear that slight shudder of the ground, you know, you can hear the noise of them and the effects of them. And I don't know what you can say about the Falaise Pocket. There was dead Germans all over the place. There was convoys of horse-drawn vehicles where horses were standing up dead. And I can remember one occasion I opened an ambulance, and I just cursed myself for my curiosity on that occasion, because as I opened this ambulance, at eye level, and I was looking straight at it, was a headless body with a big black stump in the middle, you know. And as much as you're used to seeing things out there, you know, that really took me out of my stride, you know. And there was vehicles with the Germans laid dead across the top of the stores and stuff they had on the vehicles. There was, Germans all over the place. And I'll never forget on one occasion, we were standing by and our tents were coming round, and there was a German officer there, and a little scrop, I don't know if it was a doctor or what, and he had a large cigar in his mouth, and on the ground was a German who was badly wounded, you know, was in great pain, and he had a couple of friends there, and the tent come round, and he come near to the stretcher, which was on a couple of metal stands, you know, it was a stretcher you carry, but you could rest it on the ground because it had a couple of metal angles on all four corners. And these lads had rested this on the ground, and when this tank came round, this officer wrapped his leg round one of the handles and gave it a kick. And the poor chap on the stretcher, he went absolutely blue. And so in one of my lads was so bloody disgusted with this that he made no bones about it, just put a right hander on this officer, knocked him to the ground.
Had he done it deliberately?
Yeah. Well, I don't think deliberately. He'd done it without, it wasn't malicious, but he'd done it without care for the chap on the stretcher, you know. Just wrapped his hand around it and pulled the stretcher, wrapped his leg around it, the handle, and pulled the stretcher over. And you could visibly see the chap, his face went absolutely blue on the stretcher. He must have been so much pain. Of course, it's only just one of my chaps, he just turned around it, bang, and he hit him. Cigar and all went sprawling. But there was terrible sights there, absolutely terrible. You know, men, horses, I mean, in 1940, I had a young brother of 14 killed in an air raid. And the effect of it on my mother was such that she died 4 months later. And I put that all down to Germans. And as much as I detested Germans, at for lays, you wouldn't be human if you couldn't have some small or modicum of sympathy for what they'd gone through.
Was this man on the stretcher a wounded German or a wounded English?
A wounded German, yeah.
And the soldier who hit the officer was English?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was one of my lads. We were standing there together and they were in front of us. You know, they was all over the place. There was Germans. They were, whatever they were doing, they were in captivity. You know, there was no question about that. But this officer was standing there and smoking his big cigar, and he just hooked his leg round the stretcher and give it a pull, and the poor chap went absolutely blue, you know.
So the officer was just trying to move the stretcher?
Well, he's trying to move it, yeah. But I mean, he could have said to the two people that were carrying the stretcher, move that stretcher over. But nonchalantly, he just hooked his leg round it and caused great suffering to the casualty. I wouldn't have thought he'd have pulled through the casualty, but do you know, it's strange, but I can remember on one occasion driving down a road, and at night time we kept stopping. And we got to a crossroad, and the vehicle in front of me had the platoon sergeant, and he was acting as platoon commander because we had casualties. And by the time traffic had passed this way, he'd lost the column and he took the wrong road. So he came to a big house and he stopped. And he went into this house and he came out to me and he said, come in and have a look at this. And when he went in there, it was a hospital. It was a large house, like a mansion. And there was Germans all over the place. And down the far end, he took me down the far end and he said to me, I've been talking to that officer. He said, all these people down here are going to die. He said, you know, we're so short of, the officer said, they're so short of medical medicines and supplies to deal with the casualties, that lot are going to die. And, you know, if atmosphere of complete depression comes over, you know, realisation of what war is all about, you know, even if you don't notice it when you're in battle. But, you know, that hospital really was the sad state that the Germans were in terms of medical supplies, medical attention, and to that extent, we on the British side could consider ourselves fortunate, you know, having first-class services in terms of backup. But after the Falaise Gap, I think that, you know, calm was captured, and it then, the battle moved from the Normandy Bocage, and we broke out. And I can remember one incident when we broke out. My platoon was attached to a squadron of tanks. That's how they split the things up. You know, we used to carry out a function similar to the German Panzers, Panzer Grenadiers. You know, they were infantry with the tanks and looking after tanks. You know, you can understand tanks won't go down a road, particularly a wooded road, if there's likely to be bazookas or 88mm guns about the place. So it's the infantry that have to, you know, clear these places before the tanks can move on. And that was the job of mechanised infantry, and that's what we were doing. Well, on this occasion, after the breakout, I can remember we were merrily going down the road, attached to a squadron of tanks, just one platoon. That's how they used to split us up. A company attached to a regiment of tanks, and the platoon split up into the squadrons of the tanks. So each squadron had a platoon of infantry with them. And we're going down one day, and I'll never forget the experience this day. The officer came to me and he said, there's around about 300 Germans in a field. He said, he gave me a map reference down this road, turn right. He said, and the field is across. So he said, I want you to go down there and get them on the road. He said, take no chances. He said, treat the matter tactically. He said, we think they're giving themselves up, you know, give it best. But he said, take no chances. So with that, I detached myself from the main body and went down. So I decided that the best thing to do was to pull past the main entrance. I was in this big farmhouse and big fields. Pulled past it and approached the thing tactically. So I crawled through some barbed wire fencing and I saw two large oak trees. So I crawled through around the oak trees and I'm ushering the rest of the section in. And so I pulled the section up short, I got through some barbed wire, and saw two large oak trees. So I'm trying to get the rest of the section through. I could see these Germans in the field beyond. And when they'd all got through, I went to go through these oak trees, and I looked up, and there's a big bull snoring and... couldn't get out of the place quick enough, so I thought to myself, well, you know, in spite of all the tactical skill I was trying to employ, the best thing is to go through the main gates boldly. So I went through the main gates boldly. I selected a place for the brain gun. So we got these Germans lined up. They were all over the place, and we had to wave them in, and got them lined up, about 300 of them. So I thought to myself, we'd get them on the road and then rejoin our party. So I'm walking down and I see one chap, he's got his hands up in the air and he's got a grenade in his hand. I recognise the type of grenade, which was one that goes off instantly, you know, once it's thrown, immediate explosion. So I saw it out the corner of my eyes, so I went over to the lad, so I said, the chap there got a grenade. I said, I'm going back there. I said, and I'm going to give him a burst from his stun gun. So, and this is where, on this basis, is why I evaluated a stun gun as being rubbish. So I went there and in front of him, and I must have been from here to that door. And I let out...
That's about, what, 8 feet?
I let out a burst, and they were all landing in front of him, none of them hit him. Of course, the rest of them, thinking that we were shooting, mowing them down, just dispersed, run for their lives. And, of course, I had the bling gun open up to put over their head so as to bring them to ground, and got them all in again. What happened to the chap with the grenade, I don't know, in the confusion. We lost him. Brought them all in again, give them a wide berth, and changed the grenade. I looked, I couldn't see him anyway, but eventually it took about another half hour to marshal them up and get them onto the road. So we got them onto the road and just marched them back, you know, in our direction, pointing where to go. And at that time there was lots of our traffic going along, so we were sure they were all right. Anyway, the next thing we done was to say that we'll have to rejoin our company, or platoon, which now must be miles away, you know, because they were going at a fairly reasonable speed when we detached. But in fact, we got down the road, we heard machine gun fire, and in fact, they were in action. So when we got there, there was a battle going on, and the rest of our platoon were involved in it. We were only one section. The other two sections were involved in the battle, you know. So some of the lads said to me, "Look, Fred, see Gibbsy, Field Marshal Gibbs, you know, the company. So we can go up there." So I went over to a truck. He's on the, you know, he's on the wireless operating things. So I said, "Can we join our platoon, sir?" So he said, "Well, look, Corporal Cooper, don't worry," he said, "they're on their way back." Well, when they come back, you never see such a sight in your life. The officer had half his foot shot away, a chap named Stowe, and he stopped in front of me in a vehicle, and he was on his way back to hospital. So I said, "You all right, sir?" So he said, "No, I've got no." He said, "I think I've lost one of my feet," he said. "Will you do me a favour?" He said, "Get me bowl out of headquarters truck," he said, "and me mug and that." So I got it and put it under it. Another chap come back, Boynes, Lance Sergeant. His knee was out, he had a bullet. He later had to have an amputation. And we'd heard that two lads who joined us at Worthing, both 19 years old, had got killed. Chaps named Townsend and Burt. And what had happened, we're going along edge, and there was a fairly wide gap in the edge. And when I went across that, the section was exposed, and there's a German sniper with a machine gun up a church belfry, and just fired, and that was it. Shot up the entire platoon almost. Our lads got them down. What they did with him, I don't know, but it might be one of them situations in wartime where the rules of war don't apply. But I think that is an incident that sticks in my mind. The next thing I know is that, we'd gone through Holland and Belgium. We spent Christmas 44 on the River Mars at a village called Itterwald, and had some interesting experiences down there. One of the most interesting was that we're at this place called Itterwald, and it was...
called what?
Itterwald. It was a small village in Belgium on the borders of Holland. We were at... our centre line, a company of course, was Wessem on the Mars. And there used to be an isolated house about a quarter of a mile, which was included in our position. And about every third night, you had a duty down there at night time, you know, spending the entire night there in case of a German attack across the River Mars. And we used to go there, and it was never without incident. This isolated house, the Germans used to come across the river downstream and fire at it from the flanks. they fire across the river at it. They come down and fire at it from your left flank and get back. And it was never without incident. And one night when we were there, a plane came over and dropped a bomb. It was well wide in the mark, you know, but had it hit the house, would have blown it to pieces. But I took when we left, I took a picture of the old house, you know, and it was still standing when we left, and got pleasant memories of New Year's Eve, 1944, you know, New Year, 45. We're in the isolated house, and all of a sudden, a volley of fire come from the other side. Shells, machine gun fire.